May 16th, 2020, entering month three of quarantine. You know, everybody's always talking about what's different now, what they're seeing for the first time. Let me tell you this story. When I was growing up, especially when kids were like 16, 18, you had that one buddy. He'd have a joint clip that was hanging from his rearview mirror with like some beads or whatever. It was like his I'm cool without saying out loud I'm cool. Anyway, today, driving home, joint clip replaced by facial mask. It is what it is. I want one of those thermometers that actually work. For those that listen to the podcast, you know that I have predicted, foreseen some things. Let me tell you my next prediction. Places like the Grove, the Hill, especially the Hill. Let's block out a couple streets, make like a big outdoor food court. We're going to have to figure out how to do parking, but this way these restaurants with half capacity can still be doing the business, the amount of business they need to do. And I think it'd be fun, be really advantageous. At my one table on the Hill, I can have a sandwich from here, I can have a cannoli from there, I can have a pasta dish from there. Maybe nothing that happens immediately, but you heard it here first. All right, as we do, three things you should look into if you have not. Netflix, it's called Have a Good Trip, Adventures in Psychedelics. It's exactly what it sounds like, except great straight talk from a lot of cameos. Sting, Nick Offerman, Adam Scott, I'm still going, Ben Stiller, Sarah Silverman, David Kuchner, still going, Adam Richter, Judd Nelson, Dietrich Bader, I'm a fan. Shocker, some guys from the Grateful Dead also stopped by. Number two, West Wing. Pretty simple, great series. To dream what could be. Number one, ever picked up a Kansas City Star? Why do I ask, you say? Because when you do, you get to read the great Vahe Gregorian. After 25 years at the Post-Dispatch, Vahe went to Kansas City to spread his wings and fly he has. We talk St. Louis, talk Mizzou, talk Kansas City, talk life. Pay attention at the beginning or you will miss his unbelievable backstory. Let me be the first to congratulate future Missouri Sports Writing Hall of Famer, Vahe Gregorian.
Go to Overtime. Overtime with Oliver, with my dad. Tell your friends.
And we're sitting down with the bearded one, Vahe Gregorian, from your favorite Kansas City Star columnist. How you doing, man?
Well, I'm not my favorite Star columnist. Sam Mellinger is, but I like that I'm your favorite. And great to be with you, David.
You know, funny note, you're like my 16th guest, right? And of the seven guests like yourself, born in Beirut.
Wait a minute. Who else is born in Beirut?
And also four of my guests, their father also was the first person not born in America who ran Brown University. What are the odds?
I like to tell people I'm from Lebanon instead of Beirut, so they think it's part of Missouri. But you're right. You're on to me. I'm Beirut born. And you know, maybe you know this too, but it's funny. My mom's from, she was from New Jersey, and my dad was from Iran. They met in school in California, and that's how I came to be born in Beirut and why I'm in Missouri my whole adult life. Just kind of one thing after another.
You know, this is how cool your dad must be. He's got a school named after him.
You know what? He's got the Barton Gregorian Elementary School, and it is a cool thing. And we actually had occasion, it's in Providence near where he worked at Brown University. We had occasion last year to go by there, and they came running to him. It was really sweet. And I've got a Barton Gregorian Elementary School sweatshirt that I really can only wear around the house because it seems a little braggy to wear it out.
Were you there when he got the Presidential Medal of Freedom?
I was.
How's that? That must have been crazy.
It was incredible. It really was. And seems like, you know, such a long time ago. But, you know, it was pretty emotional. And you know, you think about all the implications of his road and how far he came. And he certainly has had an incredible journey, incredible set of adventures that we've gotten to follow along on. And that was almost out of body, really, to be there in the White House. If I recall correctly, I think it was the same year Arnold Palmer got his. And Doris Day was supposed to get it, and she was going to come, but I think she had a some kind of illness or fear of flying or something. So, but I Arnold Palmer was that year too. I'm 99% sure. For some reason, it's all a blur.
No pressure on you growing up.
Why do you think I became a sports writer? I kind of needed to, you know, get out of the shadow. And I'm kind of joking about that, but I don't know how that works. You know, my dad was always an educator, still is an educator. He's 86 and still works full time with the Carnegie Corporation. And I think I always had a little bit of a notion to teach, but I think sports got in my blood early. And I think that somehow or another, my path just unfolded that way to wanting to be around sports. Initially, I thought I would be a high school English teacher and football coach, but somehow I ended up going to journalism school at Missouri for grad school because I had some kind of, I don't know, thirst for something different than what I thought my path would be.
So you grew up in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, mostly. We lived in California when I was really young, and then we were in Austin, Texas before we went to Pennsylvania. We went to Pennsylvania when I was in sixth grade, but Austin was, I think, influential because it was a great place, but also I think it's where I caught the football fever. You know, my first football games were at the University of Texas, going to games there. And Daryl Royal, the legendary Texas coach, actually once came to our house for a faculty party. And I still remember being out in the street and, you know, trying to throw a football around in case he was watching. somehow it didn't stay with him. But I did. I really got the fever for football being in Texas, and it kind of led to a lifelong love of the game.
After high school, you then go to the University of Pennsylvania, where you do play some football.
Yeah, I like to say that I played left out, which is kind of true. But I'll tell you what. So at Penn, there was a freshman team, and that season went actually pretty well. I broke my ankle, though, in three places and tore two ligaments and needed an operation. I wasn't so fast to begin with. I didn't get faster from that. And by the time I got to senior year, I thought I had a pretty good camp senior year, but the coach, whose name you'll know, Jerry Burnt, Coach Burnt pulled me aside and said he'd love to play me, but I wasn't fast enough for my size and not big enough for my speed, which was kind of a nice way of letting me down, I think.
I think I was kind of the same way.
Yes. A lot of us know that that distinction. But here's the punchline, and this is really true. It's too bad. I would like to have played, but actually it was part of an incredible experience of being part of something bigger than yourself. And, you know, I have deep friendships with a lot of those guys to this day. And we had quite a thing happen. I mean, we won two games in 3 years. Freshman, sophomore, junior year, the varsity won two games in 3 years. And my senior year, though, we tied for the Ivy League championship. And that led to a real turnaround in Penn football. And I think it led to a feeling of just, you know what, stay with things and you can appreciate the whole spectrum of the downs and the ups and what it takes to get there. And I really think that was very meaningful experience in my life, even though I didn't get to play much.
Well, and the thing that I didn't realize about Penn until hooking up with you and knew, and I needed to talk about something, the history. They got John Heisman was from there. The stadium's the oldest that's still in existence. Something about the most football games ever played by a university. Is that true?
That might be true. I don't know that for sure, but I do know the history is deep and you know, pretty profound. I mean, through on into the 60s, there were a lot of Penn moments that were kind of national moments. And, powerhouse at times, guys like Chuck Bednarik playing there. And, you know, we used to joke, those of us who didn't get to play that much used to joke that we're in contention for the Frank Heisman Award, John's lesser known brother. But the Heisman thing, you know, stands over the program. Franklin Field is an amazing place, you know, home of the Penn Relays for many years. Eagles played there for a long time. And in fact, my senior year, what was kind of cool was, it wasn't cool that the NFL was on strike, but the voice of the Eagles, Merrill Reese, did our games. And the history of Franklin Field was a big part of that appeal. I mean, it's really just an awesome thing to go back to. And the combination of Franklin Field and the Palestra is really, it's tough to beat in college sports.
And do I ever vaguely remember some story about you had a ring and you lost the ring or something?
Oh, that's funny. This must have been, you know, when we saw each other a lot, because the topic doesn't come up much. But when I got to St. Louis, a couple years after I got there, my apartment got robbed and they took almost nothing, but they got a couple pieces of jewelry. And one of them was the Penn football ring, which was really, you know, a pretty meaningful thing to me. And that's how I always remember that they only took the meaningful thing, not much of value to anybody else. But as my friend Bob Rose of the Post-Dispatch said, I moved out of that apartment faster than I write most stories after that happened and went to a different place.
And you never got it back?
Never got it back. Kind of poked around to see, you know, if I could. But, you know, in the end, I think also there's a lesson in that, right, that it's the memories, not the symbols. And I wish I had it, but it's okay.
After high school, after college, we end up at Pop Warner.
Yeah, and that was a funny thing. Pop Warner National Headquarters, the youth football headquarters, was in Philadelphia. And I was not really sure what I wanted to do. And this presented itself, and it looked like everything I wanted to do. I fancied myself someone who wanted wanted to write, and it was involved with youth sports, involved with football, but it just really didn't work out. It was a small organization, and I was really the first newcomer in a while, and ultimately I just ended up leaving the job, which is kind of funny at that age. But at that time, my roommate also got laid off like a day after I quit the job. So for a few months after that, we were both getting up, working the phones pretty hard early in the morning. And then by 2 o'clock, we didn't know what to do with ourselves. There was a day where we went to the movies since we could afford a matinee, and we ended up going to Vision Quest, and there was nobody else in the theater. And we sort of thought we hit rock bottom about then. And I ended up taking a job at a grocery warehouse in South Philly called Jetro Cash and Carry. And there was an internship in there with the Eagles and stuff like that. But all these things were great for me, but I just wasn't finding any direction. I'm saying this all in one breath, but at that point I just sort of thought, I kept talking about writing and not doing it. So a family friend suggested, there's this great journalism school in Missouri. Why don't you apply there and see what that does? And I was like, okay, I'll try it. That's what I did.
So how is Kathy Pollack doing nowadays?
Thanks for reading about that, and thanks for asking. Kathy, we lost Kathy a couple years ago, but she really lives with us. She was my mom's best friend and just a wonderful person in our lives. And her husband, Lou Pollack, was a federal judge and a fascinating man himself. He was involved as a clerk with Brown versus Board of Education. And I bring him up because he officiated our wedding at the lovely old cathedral, not old cathedral, the old courthouse in downtown St. Louis some years ago. So the Pollacks are very important in our lives and always will be.
So at the Missourian, explain to me who Dan Kelly is.
Well, Dan Kelly was the sports editor at the Missourian. And I get there and have no idea what I'm doing. And, you know, insert your punchline here about who knows what they're doing now, but Dan was great. I mean, Dan, it was very fundamentals based, but also very just logic and observationally based what we were learning, and very practical. I mean, he sat down with you with every story you typed and kind of ripped it to pieces, but not just gratuitously, but with a method to the madness. And you start kind of getting a feel for both what is just baseline right way to do things, but also within that, I think you start getting a feeling for, you know, that wiggle room where you find your own voice, so to speak, and things like that. And so I could never thank Dan enough for all he did. And and we had great experiences with people around us. It was really a great incubator. And as you know, that incubator included experiences with the coaches. Although this is kind of funny, I never did cover Norm Stewart in grad school. I didn't cover him until after I got to the Post-Dispatch. Mm. But I covered a lot of Missouri football and also Rockbridge girls basketball, which I'm also grateful for. I had a great experience with Coach Lisa Holt and just kind of getting to learn through them.
Now, before we go into Mizzou a little bit, this is what I've talked to other guys about. They don't realize that Norm Stewart, especially Norm Stewart, because the football program wasn't any good, but Norm had to deal with all these young journalist wannabes who had big egos and wanted to be cutthroat and wanted to break the big story. And he had to put up with these guys every year. That in and of itself, I much rather would have been the head coach at UCLA than deal with 18 wannabe journalists every year.
I would think that would be complicated for Norm. And I see both sides of this, because on one hand, I always thought if Norm thought about it this way, he could think of himself as, you know, almost being a teacher that way, right? Obviously, he had a basketball program to run and maybe didn't want to think of himself as having to nurture dealing with dopes like us when we first get there, right? But on the other hand, I could also see how it would wear him down. And there were some controversial things going on around his program, too, and that made it, you know, a little more intense. It's funny, Norm is a fascinating man, and over the years, I've really developed a really great relationship with him. I'm in touch with him now all the time. But we knocked heads quite a lot, as many reporters did with Norm. And, your relationships are kind of hard earned that way.
You know, I haven't told this story before, but when I was at school, there was a 1-hour program, basketball 101. And the first day, Norm's the teacher. And he's never there the rest of the semester, but he's there for the first day of class. It's an actual elective. I'm getting an hour's worth of credit. And he starts the class by saying, okay, who out here are pre-med? And the pre-med guys raise their hand, and he goes, you guys all get A's. We need good doctors. We need good people. Who's all here in the engineering program? And then people raise their hands. And they're like, okay, you guys all get B's because we need good buildings and good structure and good – who's all journalism majors in here? And I raise my hand. He's like, Oliver, don't even bother showing up. You're flunking. You're not getting a grade. We don't need one more journalist in this world. And that's
that makes me think of something. And I can see your reaction to that. I could picture his face saying it. Norm was so harsh sometimes that I think people lost track of how funny he was. I mean, he was both. He had an edge sometimes that was really a bit much. On the other hand, he was very smart, very funny, and actually very deep in a lot of ways. I treasure my time covering him. I really do. But for all of us at that age, David, I mean, everything is new, and you know, we're all kind of raw about not only our knowledge but our feelings. So there was quite a lot going on in our heads during those times, weren't there?
So what was fun was, you're right, once you didn't have a microphone in front of you and you were just talking with them, he was great. He knew my dad. Well, that's my Vahe Gregorian story. So you start at the Post in 88, and I'm going to go through some Mizzou stuff that I wanted to get your feel on, because really from 85 to 05, you probably have the most unique perspective of what was the University of Missouri's football program and basketball program athletics at the time. But here's my Vahe Gregorian's an awesome guy story. So I'm a journalism major, and I've got like 5 jobs that pay a collective $100 a week, because I'm doing this overnight shift at the radio station, and I'm doing TV, photography. And my dad is just quietly very concerned that, you know, what am I doing? Where am I going? And during basketball season, we sat somewhat close to each other on press row, and my dad, for the first time, thought I actually had a shot when you would come by and shake his hand and say, no, journalism, it's okay. And like twice a year, I'd get a story. Like even games I didn't attend, you would be nice enough to, if you were in the area, pop by and say hi to Mr. Oliver. And so that is my Vahe Gregorian is a great guy story.
Well, it's a nice story, but it's also a Mr. Oliver was a really nice guy to me story too. So I enjoyed that. And you know, this is really true, and I know you have found this too. You're personable, and you've enjoyed the relationships over the years. I had no idea going into this that how much our colleagues, even colleagues we compete with, how much all of that was going to be a sustaining and you know, just fulfilling part of what this job would be, right? When you think about doing these sorts of jobs, what you really think about is getting in your silo and doing the work and concentrating and whatever the medium is. But I don't know how I would have enjoyed this if not for those relationships. And of course, the relationships you form with those you cover or your audience and all these things. But I think it's something a little bit, I don't know if it's unique, but certainly distinct to our broader profession that we get to have those sorts of relationships. And I know, as you referred to with that, when you were young, I can tell you that people like Jim Thomas and Rick Hummel, my goodness, the way they made you feel when you had no faith in yourself. And every one of those people, it was just incredibly influential, the people that would take the time, right? And it's not hard to give time, you discover over the years. And I sort of feel like it's built in that we should be caring about those who care about this.
You know, that's it. Walk with me on this one. So people ask, what athlete is the easiest, nicest athlete to deal with? And most people say hockey. You know, baseball, you've got your Barry Bonds of the world, football. But when it comes to media, I think newspaper writers are like hockey players. They're the nicest of all the – because the TV guys are jerks sometimes. The radio guys are always fighting for time. I think the writers are the only – they're kind of like the hockey players. They're the nicest of everybody that's doing the same thing.
Well, I certainly know writers in a different way, right? I mean, actual teammates at the Post-Dispatch, teammates at the Star, and probably have had quite a number – longer, stronger, deeper relationships with writers, just because it's the nature of the beast. I mean, whether it's going to the Olympics or the, you know, NCAA tournament, whatever, you know, you gravitate to the writers. Those are the ones you see the most. And I do find a commonality. This is not to distinguish the writers from other branches of the service, but the commonality that I see all the time is a certain curiosity is what drives people to this, and a passion for the work. I think also respect for the craft, whatever you want to call it, of the written word. All those things, I think, come together in that bit of persona you're referring to, David. And it is funny, the hockey player thing, a quick story. Just, I remember the first time going into the Blues locker room. I'd had that first summer I was at the Post-Dispatch going over to Cardinals. It was a surly group. At the Cardinals, a lot of guys that would turn their back on the room, and you know, some guys that would light up for the camera, but really I was like, these baseball players aren't so enjoyable. I didn't like that very much. And I thought, I don't even know how people form relationships. And I that was part of why I enjoyed watching Rick Hummel at work, and you see the respect people had for him, and you realize it takes time. But the point is, going over to the Blues locker room for the first time, I walk in and I'm a fish out of water, of course, but I'm supposed to talk to Brett Hull. And I can't find Brett Hull, and I'm just meandering around the room. There's nobody in there, really. And Peter Zezel comes walking over to me, and he goes, "Hey, I'm Peter Zezel. I don't think we've met. Can I help you with something?" Like, what? And I knew of Peter Zezel because he had played for the Flyers when I was back in the Philadelphia area. So that was exactly my introduction to hockey, and I've thus felt and seen evidence of it after that too, but that set a tone for me about how I look at the hockey player and all this.
The Checkerdome, you ever get in the bottom of that thing? I'm always, to this day, I'm just thankful it didn't collapse while we were all in that thing.
I am, but I miss the place. I love that place, and remember, I think Jeff Gordon often wrote about the Cats, Damien and Scorch. I think they were in there.
They had pillars. They had pillars holding up the building where they had like sawn off the bottom and put new concrete underneath. When that thing shook, the fans thought, oh, this is great. This building's rocking. And it was like, no, this thing really is rocking.
No, you don't understand. This is rocking. I'll tell you this. I thought about this the other day. We had, we were working on some kind of set of lists of, you know, great things we'd seen or something like that. And that triple overtime game with Missouri-Illinois, there were a lot of, you know, when we think of the great events we've gotten to go to or games we've seen or anything of that nature, naturally you think of the things that are the championships or the end or the biggest, you know, the Olympics, the title games. But I always think of that game among the most just exhilarating, fascinating things I ever got to cover. I mean, I remember getting home that night, unable to sleep for hours, just replaying that game. And I know my great friend Mike Smith, who was so instrumental in me getting to work at the Post-Dispatch, I remember him talking to me about his family being up, you know, almost the rest of the night talking about the game. And I that's my Checkerdome / arena memory. I hated when it came down, but I'm sure it had to come down.
I don't think I've ever seen a double pump three-pointer like Jason Sutherland in that game.
No, and I don't know that – was that what he set out to do? you know, by the way, I've still never figured out what to do with this, but my dear friend Stu Durando and I went when they were selling the arena seats out and got a couple each. I've still got them in my basement, and I kind of kept thinking I would get them built or I would – no, I don't want to make it sound like I would ever do it myself because I don't have the skills, but get it built into some kind of, framework where you can sit on them. But I haven't been able to do that. I got to figure that out.
I got one that Kelly already set up. So you've got the handles, you got the armrests.
Yeah, but it need to be put into a platform.
Okay.
That's the thing. So one day I'll figure it out. You'd think that during a pandemic, when you got some time on your hands, might be the time to figure it out, but I haven't quite gotten to that.
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about Mizzou. Again, let's just frame it off. Let's say from 85 to 05. Now, you don't get there until the late 80s. But the one thing I don't think people understand about Mizzou athletics, in the late 70s, early 80s, they were just asleep at the wheel when it came to what their competition and the other universities were doing. And I think that hurt them for longer than people recognize. Agree or disagree?
I think that's right. I think, you know, you have to think this through a little bit, but, you know, they were having some good things happen, right? I mean, that was, they were on the cusp of a golden time with basketball. Football had kind of come, you know, the crazy Alana Frio era, they'd kind of come out of that with some big years with Warren Power, some big wins, but also some dips. But at the heart of all this, I think, I didn't really understand this till the Bob Stoll era, when you start realizing that they were neglecting kind of the infrastructure. They were, you know, remember the whole thing with I can't remember if they called it seat license or whatever it was, but there was something with that alienated longtime fans. There just was an incoherence to some of the approach. And, you know, chicken and egg on this, a lot of turnover. I mean, 4, 5, 6 chancellors in like 12 years, 4, 5, 6 athletic directors in like 7 years, just a lot of turnover. So naturally what happens with that is you might get a hire, like let's say Woody Widenhofer, and you're a couple of ADs into it by the time, you know, he's at that, what do you do with this situation thing. And I don't know that they should have kept on with Woody, but I think his last year they were 5-6. Mm-hmm. And so you just got this cycle going. And then just some bad luck, right? I mean, Bob Stoll was the most coveted coach in the country, or among them. A lot of people wanted to hire him, and he put together a staff. People knocked the staff, and you go on to have, I think, 4 NFL head coaches from that staff. But you get things like the fifth down and things like that. I always joke that if you had a parallel universe where they won that game, Bob Stoll's still the coach, and they've got a statue of him out there with Coach Faroe. And there's no way to know that, but I just think some odd things also happened. But you're right. First and foremost, there was a certain kind of neglect, just sort of this assumption that things would, you know, regenerate themselves. And meanwhile, they're not keeping up with the space race.
No, it sounds simplistic, but the OmniTurf hurt them for a couple graduating classes.
It did. And, you know, I remember one of Larry Smith's big pitches when he took over the job was, you know, we're going to get grass back out there. We're going to bloody noses. And that was speaking Missouri fan, right? I mean, he had a very good sense of the pulse of that. And that happened not long after, if I remember correctly. But yeah, well,
for those who don't remember, when it rained, it was like running on a beach.
Yeah, I remember. Well, I've still got a piece of that OmniTurf over here somewhere, and I swear this is true. If this is 25 years later, if I pick it up, a bunch of sand is still falling out of it. I swear that's true. So I don't touch it too often. But it, you're right. It was really horrendous and embarrassing. And I don't know how much it played a factor in recruitment and things like that, but I imagine there were people that saw that and thought, why am I going to play on this field? And you know, just crazy. And you know, that's another one of those things, right? Within a year or two of putting that in, it was evident there was a real problem, and they just kind of wrote it out. Maybe I'm being unfair, but I think that was also part of that. Like, oh, it's all right, it'll work out. And then once you get into that death spiral, you know, in football, it can take a long time. I mean, there's certain sort of miracle workers out there who can take over a program and transform things pretty fast, but football is a much steeper uphill climb. Takes a lot more things just working out. Doesn't mean it can't, but just takes a lot more things to fall into place to get it right.
So also during this period of time, Norm's lack of interest in the NCAA tournament was painful.
Yeah, and it's funny, you know, it's very well put that you phrase it that way. I mean, in one sense, obviously he understood by then that the NCAA tournament was the real signature of the season. But in another sense, he was I think, still enthralled with you know, the near term, the Big Eight, and, you know, winning the conference. And I think you could draw a chart that almost shows how many times those teams peaked in mid-February and were burned out by early March. I mean, I think I've talked to people around the program that, you know, with you know, deep insight to their time within, and they always thought that. And Norm just burned them out. I've never had a really substantial talk with Norm about that, but I think I could, and I'd be interested to hear him, you know, look back and just talk about, you know, how much, you know, maybe he could have eased the throttle a little. It's hard to know, right? I mean, you know, nobody wants to say, you know, well, slow down right now, but there's a difference between playing at maximum intensity and just, you know, draining everything out of people. And Norm was so intense that I think that had a tendency to happen.
You know, what's interesting is I haven't had him on yet. We're hopefully going to get that done sometime in June. He was out of the country till like 2 weeks ago. Looking at research and just kind of taking a step back, I think he really enjoyed beating the coaches in the conference. And like from there, he got the big, you know, he got the conference championships. But I think he hated to lose to Johnny Orr. I think he hated to lose to Billy Tubbs. And when you got to the NCAA tournament, he wasn't playing. He wanted to win. I mean, he's as competitive as anybody that we know, but he didn't have that inner thing going on against he beat Bobby Knight in the conference in the NCAA tournament, because I think he would have despised losing to him. But I think when it came against, you know, playing Colorado State, I don't think he just lit the fire the same way.
Well, there is something about certain competitors. I wouldn't know whether I could say this definitely about Norm, but that there's that difference between desire to win versus, you know, hatred of losing, and there is a difference. I think there is, and maybe they go hand in hand, but there's a little difference. You know, that's an interesting thought about that, you know, was sort of personal, but the other part of that personal is something that's was a little obscured by the entertainment value. I think Norm had great relationships with Johnny Orr and Billy Tubbs and those guys. There was a lot of theater in what was going on with that whole, you know, I can't remember exactly how these exchanges started, but you know, Francis, the talking mule, or Mr. Ed, and all this stuff. And then one time Billy was going to sue Norm and just mocking each other openly. We were talking about this, some colleagues of mine at the Star and I the other day, about it, that's kind of a bygone era, right? These guys openly bickering, and also you kind of feel like there was a little wink in the background. Now, I know Norm, when I talked to him a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about some of this, just talking casually to catch up, and he reminded me that he frequently had dinner with Billy Tubbs out there in Palm Springs over the last few years. That he hasn't seen Billy for a little while. But by the way, a little quick aside, sorry I'm rambling, but little known fact, Billy Tubbs was born, I think, near Jefferson Barracks, whatever the hospital is down there. And I think he lived there just for like 6 months. But every time I called Billy, he would always say, when I was calling from St. Louis, he would always say, "It's always good to hear from my hometown paper."
Did you ever get an I Jog with Billy Tubbs t-shirt?
No. Did you get one yourself?
I knew that was like probably 5 years or so before we got there, but I knew people who had them.
Oh God. Anyway, it was a lot of good fun there. And I'm sure I totally digressed from your actual question, but yeah.
Norm leaves the program. I remember this true story, Vi. I'm watching the NCAA finals, and it's halftime. Duke's playing, and they're interviewing Quinn Snyder, not Krzyzewski, at halftime. And I'm in the room. I'm like, that guy is going to be coaching somebody next year. Sure enough, it's Mizzou. And you have some success. You have some new heights. But at the end of the day, it's pretty much Ricky Clemens in a nutshell.
Yeah, that's right. One quick thing on Quinn. You know, I remember I was doing more kind of regional, national stuff at the time. I was still, you know, tethered to covering some Missouri, but also, you know, we had, I think Bill Coates was covering Missouri, and I was out doing some other things. So that, I hope the timing's right on this. It was either that year, that season, or the season before. I was at couple Duke things, and I think to write about Chris Carrawell, maybe something else. But, and Quinn was the guy talking at length in the locker room after the games. And you know, that maybe some programs do this, but I haven't seen too many assistant coaches made available. But I remember, like everybody else, being mesmerized by his eloquence and intelligence. And you could tell he was going places. And look, I think in the end, they gave him the keys to the kingdom, and with really not enough, just assuming that everything would be done right. Everything was, he comes from Duke, these sorts of things. And instead it was pretty chaotic and, you know, corrupt in a lot of ways. And the Ricky Clemens thing was what illuminated it all. That was a bizarre story, every aspect of it. You know, I think Quinn in some ways was just not ready for all that. I mean, I think that's pretty fair to say. And maybe he hadn't become the person he wanted to be yet. I mean, that's maybe a little unfair. But I think he absolutely sort of reinvented himself after that, and the hard way, right? By going to, I think, Europe and going to the developmental league and all this. And it looks like he's pretty good command of his life now, and I'm happy for him.
So as the football program is going down, sorry, basketball program is going down, football program is elevating itself. Gary Pinkel as a head football coach is about as procedural as I've ever seen. I mean, he's mapped out by 5-minute increments. When you're seeing the difference between him and the predecessors, are you feeling things could change, or are you still kind of wait and see? I didn't get it right away.
No, I can't say I thought, oh, this is going to be, you know, the magic, or I didn't see that. And you know, it's easy to forget that Larry Smith had a couple pretty good years there. And then, you know, I think it turns out, we found out later, Larry was sick, and, you know, some people left, and I don't know if they, the people that hired them in their place kind of fit right. And you know, Curtis Jones died, and that was important, and all these sorts of things. But to your point, Gary was, it was just a much more vague concept of whether this would work when he came in. I mean, we didn't know if that stuff would convert from Toledo to Missouri, and you didn't know that that staff would be seen as you know, worthy of the job, right? There was a lot, like with Bob Stull's staff, there was a lot of criticism of Gary's staff, and as it turned out, the continuity of Gary's staff was crucial and huge in what came. I do remember, you know, I spent some time, good chunks of time with Gary early on before he coached his first game. I went down with him one day to Jefferson City for him to talk to Missouri Coaches Association, and all the other stuff I'd seen in Gary was like, boy, he's pretty, he's sort of mild mannered, and I'm not sure what his personality, how much personality he has. When I saw him in front of that room, that was when I sort of thought, okay, well, I see that aspect to him. He's got the charisma that maybe we didn't see at the press conference. And also, there was one of those days during there, I remember we were walking into the facility, and he was bothered by the doorknob on whatever, you know, the main entrance that was. And he was like, he just turned to me and goes, well, that's going to be changed too. And I just remember thinking, all right, he's a control freak. And that's what this job calls for. Will it work? You know, you just don't know. And again, one of those things where, you know, I think a lot of people can pinpoint that game. I think it was 2006 when they're losing to Iowa State. And Brad Smith gets hurt, and that Daniel kid comes in and saves the day. You know, that sort of, you know, the trajectory was not what it needed to be, and there was some question of whether he'd survive that season if they didn't get it going. And then look what happened after that. It was a pretty great run, right? I mean, especially 2007, but a lot of good years in there that they were really fun to watch and really good.
2007 is obviously, I know, one of my five favorite games is the showdown. You reported on that game. Is it a top five for you?
Yeah, I think so. You know, when it specifically comes to games, think of all that was in play there. First of all, it was just an incredible game, which I think it's funny. You think about the results sometimes as being the only thing that matters and, you know, how you look at, you know, whether something's monumental or not. But I think maybe there's a parallel to this with how anything that's hard earned is more interesting and better. The game itself was a great game. The implications were kind of unbelievable. I mean, it, you know, suddenly Missouri's number one, second time in program history. And, you know, it's a shame that, you know, it didn't last, right? That the nemesis of Oklahoma was there. But it was as exciting, and the crowd was fantastic. You had really a 50-50 KU-MU crowd. That made it, it just was a moment in time to freeze and absolutely hold on to like that. I agree with you.
So as we wrap up this part about Mizzou, do you remember Les Carpenter?
Of course.
Okay. So this isn't Les's story. This is me retelling Les's story about Missouri and the Big Ten. He's got a friend who's reputable, who swears Alden was in a room with four to five important people waiting for the call from the Big Ten to announce they wanted Mizzou, and the call never came. True story or not?
I've heard some stories like that, and this was a fascinating and very uncomfortable time because there was so much mysterious, so much fluid stuff that – I'll just say this, my headlights never got to that. And I don't dispute it, but my headlights never took me that far. And that was part of the problem. There was a lot of misdirection and even open lying and from some people to others, and it just became a mess. It was a hard time. It was a hard time in the media, because I think people felt the need to defend their reporting. Twitter, it was, you know, we were on into the Twitter time, and there was some the only time I ever remember there being a lot of kind of like, this guy's an idiot in the media, and this guy has it right, this guy doesn't, all that kind of stuff. But it was because there was such a secretive element to it. I think there were probably things signed that maybe prevented people from talking more openly. In hindsight, I've come to feel, not with any certainty, but I've come to feel that at least the essence of that concept was true, that Missouri had reason to believe that the Big Ten was gonna make the invite, and then something just happened. I've come to believe that. I certainly wouldn't say it as fact, but it's my sort of guiding belief.
All right, because you're too humble, let's talk about getting nominated for a Pulitzer Prize in 2000.
Well, it was an amazing thing, and you know that I don't know how far into the process it went, but I the nomination happened. It was based on a story about Sammy Henson, the wrestler from St. Charles, who lost gold, some would say won silver at the 2000 Olympics in Sydney. And the story resonated with a lot of people. It did end up in a book, The Best American Sports Writing. And the reason I bring that up is an important reason. It is, I'm glad I was in position to do it, but why that story came about was something really fundamental to what works in journalism. It's about having relationships and being given the time to work on things. I knew Sammy really well because the Post-Dispatch allowed me to go down to Oklahoma and spend some time with him in training before the Olympics. So consequently, by the time we got to Sydney, and Sammy was going through this unbelievable emotional roller coaster, he still wanted to talk to me. And he really opened up, and even then it was about 8 hours after he competed. He was in a bathtub still wearing his uniform, and he called me on the phone. It was really a weird story, and more than too much to get into here really fully. But I bring that all that stuff up just to say that anytime, you know, the commitment of the organization is put into play like that, you have a chance to tell the story better, right? You have a chance to know what you're talking about and be able to get on the inside. And really, I think the best thing we can do, and it's harder and harder in these days, but the best thing we can do in our jobs is to take the reader, take the audience where they don't get to go. And that was, I think, true of that situation with Sammy.
How does one become a Knight Wallace Fellow?
One is fortunate enough to have the editor of one's paper suggest that it might be a worthy thing to check out, because one's editor at that time had done the program. That was Ellen Soderberg. And so I applied, and it was fantastic. It was basically a sabbatical, a year off at the University of Michigan, which has a generous stipend. And you know, we were surrounded, my wife Cindy and I went, and we were surrounded by people from all over the world, and made like field trips to Argentina and Toronto, and had twice a week little sessions with great speakers like the New Yorker cartoon editor or the editor of the New York Times, or, you know, poets. And we sit around drinking sherry and talking big twice a week at the house. So it was great. It was a weird thing in a way to get off the habit trail and just step away. But my only regret about the year is that I used it up and it's gone. I mean, we just don't get to do that. And at this time, you know, at that time, there was contractual language that said my job would still be there. I mean, I nowadays with jobs so precious, you worry that it might have a chilling effect on people applying. But it was a great thing, and I think also they see the sports writer there as an exotic beast. Like you know, if you were a sports writer and applied, you might have had a better chance, just because I think it was not something they were used to having, and added a certain different kind of dimension.
You mentioned Cindy. How'd you guys meet?
We met at the Post-Dispatch. Cindy was at that time in the mid '90s working in. She came to the Post-Dispatch working in a new endeavor related to Postline, I think it was, right about the time we were about to make a change to emphasizing stltoday.com or Postnet, maybe as it was called at the time. I can't remember, but Cindy ended up coming into the fold that way, and then she ended up working in features and then covering health and science, and it was great time for her at the Post-Dispatch.
How did you propose?
Pretty weak. I had botched a chance to do it in a hammock in Puerto Rico. It was the night I was going to ask, and I just couldn't pull the trigger. And a couple weeks later, I had a certain spontaneous combustion one day. We'd just gone for a run together, and this is true. I just started crying and took a knee and asked her, and she started crying, but she didn't answer. I'm like, well, what's the answer? She goes, well, yes. Okay. So not really the most thought out, well-scripted scene. And on the other hand, I try to always remind her that, you know, it was out of pure emotion. So that seemed like a good thing.
I like it. Okay. So on the work front, I'm going to fast forward, get you to 2013. You're a trader. You leave for Kansas City.
It was hard. It was excruciating. We had no desire to leave St. Louis. But I heard from the Star about this job, which is, you know, different latitude to write things, different set of things you get to do, more freedom. And you know, I hadn't really thought about, do I need to be a columnist or not? But I do think that kind of challenge and that kind of opportunity just spoke to me. And at my age, what am I now? I'm 59 now, so I was 52, 53 then. It didn't seem like anybody else was looking at me that way. And I just sort of thought, well, let's check it out. And Cindy and I talked about it and sort of told ourselves, you know, it'd be a great adventure. And we're pretty close to St. Louis. We'll still see all our friends in St. Louis. And let's do this. And Cindy was really excited about it, and also was offered the job here as a house and home editor. So we set sail, but all I did was, I remember when this is true, I'm not sure why I'm sharing this, but I'm going to share it anyway. When it became clear I was going to go, I was pretty overcome with sadness. I mean, I was excited, but you know, when you're leaving somewhere, you don't feel the good of it, the reason you're doing it, till you arrive at the next place. And I drove right to Rams Park and just burst into tears to tell Jim Thomas, because I love Jim Thomas, and it was hard to say bye. And we were pretty off balance the first 6 months or a year, learning a new job. And you learn pretty quickly that even though some places close by, it's not the same place. And I'd been in St. Louis 25 years. So it was a hard transition that way, but we were lucky also to have good friends in Kansas City already, and people I really was excited to work with over here, especially the people I knew best, Blair Kirchhoff and Sam Mellinger. And those have been incredible relationships for me here. And I love working with everybody here. So I feel like it, as hard as it was, you know, we kept telling ourselves, we hope we're adding on to our lives instead of just switching. And we bought a house with a couple spare bedrooms so we could try to encourage friends to come with multiple family members. And we've had that happen plenty of times. So yeah, but no one wants the Hyperloop to be built more than me. I want to see the state connected and get back and forth more often.
Well, here's what I thought when I read that you were leaving. We've never talked about this, I don't think. I'm going to embarrass you for a second. You're sneaky, quiet, brilliant in regards to the fact that when you went to Kansas City and I saw that you were going to be a columnist, I was like, he's going to have the ability to do so. And I'll give you an example. It's not like I read the Kansas City Star every day, but I read it this week, and you did an article, episode, whatever, on George Brett. And the layer of that column in regards to starting in left field, walking his dog, then talking about 50 years. I mean, your ability to paint a picture was just not utilized when you were at the Post like it is in Kansas City, and that's just a fact.
Well, look, that's a nice thing to say, but it's what comes with having a job that gives you more freedom, I think. And you know, I certainly was allowed to you know, get into deeper stories of the Post-Dispatch and but it's just not the inherent freedom of this job. And it's just the nature of the beast. So, and I, you know, I want to say this too. I mean, I've been grateful that, that my sports editor here, Jeff Rosen, allowed me to figure out my own way on this. Right. I think when you become a columnist, there's an assumption that you're going to be this or that or whatever. And, I, you know, had to work to figure out, this sounds kind of hokey and, a little funny, but who was I going to be? What was I going to try to be? And I kept realizing that I need to be myself, and whatever I think the best version of that can be in this job, that's what I shoot for. And I did learn a long time ago that trying to be what somebody else wants you to be is a betrayal of yourself. And so I just really appreciate that Jeff was patient with me to let me figure out how I want to approach this. And it's allowed me to really enjoy the job.
You are Kansas City's version of Chris Kerber.
Am I? Would Chris say that?
Coming to town, Chiefs haven't won a Super Bowl in forever. And you fixed that yourself. You personally fixed that.
Well, you know, it's funny. So I get here in 2013, and I had no idea how barren the recent modern times had been in with the Royals and Chiefs. The Royals hadn't been in the playoffs since 85. Chiefs hadn't won a playoff game since the early 90s when I got here. Not one. And I hope that's right. Maybe they won one game. But they hadn't won a home playoff game since then. Okay. And anyway, I just didn't realize it was that off kilter. And so that first season, the Royals are kind of, you know, looking like they might turn the corner. And it's funny how you come to things, you know, as a blank slate. Like, I come to it from a standpoint of, well, why can't they turn the corner? Why shouldn't they? Because I haven't marinated in 28 years of futility. And, you know, I've certainly seen that the Cardinals could be pretty good. And I'm not saying I saw signs of them being like what the Cardinals were. I didn't see 2014 and 2015 coming, but I thought, well, they seem to have some pieces here. And looks to me like there's an upward trajectory. And so it just kind of, it was funny though, how that played out. I mean, Shazam, I'm here, and now the Royals are going to back-to-back World Series, and then the Chiefs are winning in the postseason. So there's no causal relationship, but I'd say I certainly prospered by that happening once I got here, because it really got me more engaged in the community, more on, you know, fast forwarded kind of into what the histories of the teams were about and the energy of it. I've always thought that fall of 2014 was in some ways almost more exciting than 2015 when the Royals won, because it was so new and so fresh and a feeling, I've told my friends in St. Louis this, a feeling that few Cardinals fans could understand because they're so used to being in the postseason all the time. It was really just incredible energy.
So you're right. I jumped the ball or jumped the gun a little bit. You get there, the Royals win two pennants, one World Series. Then I always thought of Kansas City as a football town. I always thought, you know, the stadium itself was one of the greatest places I've ever seen a football game. Not just a Missouri game, but a Chiefs game. And much like Blues fans, they just suffered for so many years. Every year, could this possibly bring in Montana, bring in Mike Keenan, bring in they really seem, it was like, to me, I thought you must have been on the phone with Jim Thomas wanting to pick his brain about the Blues' success in comparison to what the Chiefs were accomplishing. What was that like being a part of that with that town?
Well, you mean with covering the Chiefs?
Yeah.
Look, the Chiefs thing is pretty neat because but let me reframe this for 1 second. The Chiefs, I do think it still is. I think you could call it a football town, but I think it's pretty, it's closer than people might have realized. The thing that got a little maybe slightly diluted about the Chiefs, and don't get me wrong, it was absolutely, you know, out of control joy about that. But had the Royals not won in 14 and 15 the way they did, you know, it would have been a pure 50 years since anything like that happened here, with the exception of MLS, some great moments for Sporting KC. So I think, you know, it was maybe a little less just over the top than it might have been if the Royals hadn't done what they did. It's part of the energy here. But the Chiefs thing was great in so many ways. And starting with Andy Reid, who, and I've known Andy since his days at Missouri, and I have an appreciation of who Andy really is, I think. And, you know, we see a lot of sort of button down stuff out of Andy, but Andy is a great person. Andy does a lot for a lot of people, and Andy's a tremendous football coach who's just not been able to crack the code on putting it over the top. And then he gets Patrick Mahomes, and it's this kind of relationship between the two that it's uncanny, actually. I mean, they really are finishing each other's sentences, and I think that just sort of crystallized what was happening here. They had a great foundation going, a good thing going, but that just changed the formula. So to see it actually happen, and happen for Kansas City, and I know many Chiefs fans have, you know, defined the long-suffering concept. But I do think when they lost to New England last year, there was something different in the air, right? It wasn't the we'll never get there feeling that Chiefs fans had. It was this is the start of something, and we were right there. But I think it was important psychologically that the Chiefs seized on that right away and won. And I do believe the window's open for a couple more things like this in the next few years. It's a pretty young core, and when you got Patrick Mahomes, you got a chance.
What's it like to be voted the best columnist in America?
I think you call it a one-hit wonder. But, you know, I'll tell you this, though. This is true. That recognition came, as it turned out, just a few weeks before my mom died. And it was a nice thing to be able to tell her. It was.
Deservedly so. Getting ready to wrap it up with Vahe Gregorian from the Kansas City Star. If you had to choose Tennessee Williams or Frank DeFord?
Frank DeFord, near and dear to my heart. I might have been one of the last people to interview Frank before he died. We, at the Basketball Writers Association, it's a long story why he wasn't already in our Hall of Fame, but we were putting him in our Hall of Fame around that time, and I was amazed at his delight in that for somebody who's been so recognized. And I don't know that he was the reason I got into this, but he was a reason I got into this. So inspired by his writing.
Still a young man. Where's the novel in you?
I don't know about that. I used to joke that I'd write something about college basketball and the protagonist would be a guy named Strom Neuwirth. But I don't know about that. I'd like to think I have some books in me. I'll tell you this. There was a book, in fact, I can see it from here, called River of Doubt by a woman named Candace Millard that I read some years ago. It's about Theodore Roosevelt, after he loses the 1912 election, going off to chart South America and the Amazon. And it was so well written, it got me thinking that there are historical novels, I wouldn't even call it fiction in her case. It was so well documented, but just also animated by her writing. Those kind of things, there's many sorts of things like that to be drilled into and written about. And I guess if I had my druthers, I'd figure out a way to do some of those in the future.
Vahe, I really appreciate the time. Hope you had a good time.
David, thanks. It was fun. But you embarrassed me making me talk about myself, but I seemed only too happy to do it, didn't I?
Pretty good.
And there's another one for the books. Man, I look forward to the time, the day where we can sit down in a room, have a give and take conversation. But Vahe is a pro. I thought that went pretty well. Interesting to me, hopefully interesting to you. If you want to see his St. Louis 7 episode, don't forget that's on YouTube. YouTube channel is OT with Oliver, and you can see the other ones that preceded Vahe. And if you listen to podcasts on Apple and you would be kind enough to subscribe to the podcast on there as well, I would appreciate it. Vahe, next time in town, man, first round's on me. As we do, thanks for your time this time. Till next time, so long.